Central Time, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, new research from UW-Madison looks at the difference in health risks for adults with autism spectrum disorder versus adults not on the spectrum. We find out how the information could be used to provide more effective care. First, environmental groups held a news conference this afternoon about their lawsuit against the state's water diversion plan for the soon-to-be-built Foxconn facility. The suit was filed late last week and asserts the DNR ignored a requirement that diversions be for public use, like residential customers. The DNR approved a proposal last month that would allow the city of Racine to take about 7 million gallons of water daily from Lake Michigan and pipe it to the plant in Mount Pleasant, 9 miles away. Governor Scott Walker has said repeatedly that Foxconn's water diversion would not harm Lake Michigan. So what effects would this plan have on the Great Lakes, and what's next on the legal front? Chuck Kornbach is Wisconsin Public Radio's reporter in Milwaukee, and he's been covering this story. Chuck, thanks for joining us today.
Hello, and thank you.
Before we talk about the lawsuit itself, let's review this water diversion plan. What exactly did the DNR agree to, Chuck?
Well, as you say, last month they agreed to a petition or a request from the city of Racine, which has a nice drinking water treatment plant and a wastewater treatment plant that will come into play too. But the drinking water treatment plant that the city of Racine says is underutilized and has plenty of capacity to send water from Lake Michigan out to Mount Pleasant. Racine already serves village of Mount Pleasant, but would serve the portion of the Foxconn facility that's outside the Great Lakes Basin and in the Mississippi River Basin, about 8% of the village, I think. And that's the bone of contention, is that should the Racine be able to send this water out to the public, into a private entity.
And the figures we've seen have been about 7 million gallons a day that would be diverted in the way that you just described, Chuck. What would that water be used for at the Foxconn facility?
In the production process, we haven't seen all the details on that, but a plant that makes liquid crystal display screens and other devices would seem to use a lot of water, especially a very large plant that this is going to be, apparently. About 4 million gallons a day would go back to Lake Michigan through the Racine wastewater treatment plant, but about 2.7 or 3 million gallons would evaporate or somehow otherwise disappear in the production process.
How significant is that? That's a pretty large proportion of that water that's being sent every day.
It is, but it's within the Great Lakes Compact, which allows a larger amount even to be used in consumptive use. So that's not really the issue. It's the whether Racine should be the one to supply the water and whether it's a public or a private use.
So if I'm understanding what you're saying, Chuck, that percentage or that proportion would not necessarily be different if it was a different type of use. That's fairly standard operating.
Well, I think so.
We're talking with Chuck Kornbach. He's Wisconsin Public Radio's reporter in Milwaukee, and we're talking about a lawsuit that's been filed over the water diversion plan for the new Foxconn facility. And Chuck, what has Governor Walker been saying about this? He's been a big proponent of the Foxconn facility.
You know, he hasn't said too much about whether this is for a public or private use. He has focused his comments that I've heard at least twice on whether the diversion would harm Lake Michigan. He says it would not. Most of the environmental groups say that this 7 million gallons with returning 4 million would not harm Lake Michigan. It's the precedent the environmental groups are worried about.
So let's dig in on that lawsuit now. It's coming from several environmental groups. First of all, who are the organizations that have come together to file this lawsuit?
Well, it's technically called a petition for contested case hearing. The groups are asking the Wisconsin DNR, which approved the diversion, to allow this to go to be reviewed by an independent party and an administrative law judge. It's groups such as the Midwest Environmental Advocates, Milwaukee River Keeper, there's a Minnesota group, and the League of Women Voters of Wisconsin is involved as well. Their representative, Louise Petering was at a news conference today at the Milwaukee Lakeshore. League of Women Voters, the petition reminds us, works to improve our systems of government and impact policies through public policies through education and advocacy. The League, I believe, thinks that this is bad policy, the way this diversion plan was approved. And Ms. Petering said that this does seem to set a bad precedent that would eventually affect the lakes, Great Lakes, if more communities, more companies set up just outside the Great Lakes Basin and want water.
Let's listen to a quote from attorney Jody Havish-Sinikin of Midwest Environmental Advocates, one of the groups that's filing the lawsuit.
The integrity of the compact is being tested by this misinterpretation, and we believe that the compact is important enough to fight for to get the interpretation of this critical provision correct.
So, Chuck, she talks about a misinterpretation of the compact. What is she saying the DNR has misinterpreted about how these diversions can be done?
Sure. The DNR today, Communications Director Jim Dick, did not have much to say about the petition for the contested case hearing. He did say the petition is under review to determine the next steps. However, the DNR did release a document that I had not seen before, that apparently on May 3rd, the Wisconsin DNR held an informal briefing with representatives from the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence River states and provinces. In other words, the groups that have looked at other diversions, like the Waukesha diversion, of course. And in that document dated May 16th, it goes into more depth into why the DNR says they think this meets the compact, this diversion meets the compact. They said the definition of public water supply purposes requires a physically connected system that serves a group of largely residential customers. The DNR is arguing that Racine, the Racine Water Utility, is a physically connected system, has a pipe into the lake and serves customers inland, and that 90% of the Racine Water Utility customers are residential customers. So that's Racine's argument. That's the DNR's apparent argument in approving the diversion. At the news conference today, Jody Havish-Sinikin and others said that interpretation was a stretch, and that audio you played was from Friday, is what she's referring to, this misrepresentation or misinterpretation.
It's interesting, Chuck, because you said that this document that you had not seen before talks about how the vast majority of customers are private residential users, but it sounds like in that argument that they are counting Foxconn as one customer, just like, you know, maybe a household of four people, whereas I'm guessing that if it was looked at from the amount of water, it might be a little different equation then.
Well, in looking at this DNR document, I don't even see that Foxconn is listed as a residential customer. They're saying, the DNR is saying, and Racine is saying, look, we have this system, this water supply system that already serves residential customers. The compact language is silent on some of this, whether Foxconn, a company like Foxconn, would fit into the equation or not if they already serve, Racine already serves water utility residential customers.
So the groups that are filing this lawsuit want the DNR to pull its approval of the water diversion plan and hold a contested case hearing. What exactly would that mean, and what kind of timeline might that be on?
Well, that would involve the administrative law judge that we talked about, Division of Hearings and Appeals. Does that sound right? I think that's the state division that would hear this. Now, that topic came up at the news conference today. First of all, whether the DNR would agree to the contested case hearing. The attorneys for the environmental groups, Jimmy Parra was one of them, saying we think this meets the standard for this request for a contested case hearing. And then he was going on to say that it's quite possible that under legislation the legislature passed last year, that any review could be expedited, sped up, that if the law judge took the case and ruled a certain way, if this went on to a circuit court, that there's legislation that might wind, could even put this matter before the state Supreme Court in a relatively quick fashion. Now, if the administrative law judge, if that person does take the case and rules against the petitioners, the environmental groups, then maybe that's the end of it. But if the law judge rules in favor of the environmental groups, then other judges in the state sound like they could get involved very quickly.
Hmm. And Chuck, as you mentioned, the environmental groups pushing for legal action held that news conference today in Milwaukee. Anything else of note that came out of that?
Well, it was the, they reminded us it's the 10th anniversary, roughly, of when the state of Wisconsin entered the Great Lakes St. Lawrence River Basin Water Resources Compact, or what we call the Great Lakes Compact, and that they said even though it's been 10 years, some of these issues are still in their infancy in terms of getting resolved. This straddling community issue where another city, Racine, applies on behalf of Mount Pleasant or the Foxconn property is a wrinkle that really hasn't come up in the other, I guess, two cases involving the diversion on a bigger scale.
Well, Chuck, thanks for bringing us up to speed, and we'll certainly be checking back in with you as it progresses.
Thank you.
Chuck Kornbach is Wisconsin Public Radio's reporter in Milwaukee. We talked with him about the lawsuit against the state's water diversion plan for the Foxconn project. And for more information on Foxconn and issues surrounding Great Lakes water, visit wiscontext.org/Foxconn. Right now, new research published by scientists at UW-Madison looks at the health risks facing the older adult population living with autism spectrum disorder, or ASD. In the 1990s, the number of children diagnosed on the autism spectrum shot up dramatically. While the numbers of older adults with ASD is growing, autism research frequently focuses on children and adolescents. Lauren Bishop Fitzpatrick is an assistant professor of social work at UW-Madison and a researcher at the UW-Madison Weissman Center. She's the lead author of a new study about the increased health risks older adults with autism spectrum disorder may be facing. Lauren, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here.
First of all, can you talk a little about what in your work led you to this particular study?
Yeah, so I've always studied adults on the autism spectrum, but I think that something that a lot of people don't know is that autism has a really relatively brief diagnostic history, in that the first person ever diagnosed with autism, the first case, is currently in his 80s.
Oh, wow.
So, at this point, we know very, very little about the types of outcomes that people on the autism spectrum have in midlife and old age, and then more specifically, their health problems. And we've heard for many, many years from families that people on the spectrum have different types of health problems as they get older, and they might also have different health care needs and health needs.
And what are some of the conditions or diseases that people on the autism spectrum are more likely to have? I have mm-hmm. to admit, I was surprised to find out that there were those correlations.
Yeah, so this is the first study that we know of, at least, to look at the health histories of people on the autism spectrum. So we had a lot of data to look at this on a sample of people on the autism spectrum who had died. And we found that we've known for a long time that people on the spectrum have high rates of things like epilepsy and digestive problems. But in this sample, we were able to see that they also had really high rates of cardiovascular problems, as well as motor problems, ear problems, infections. And then we also saw lots of long-term medication use and its side effects.
And was that surprising to you? Did you expect that many things to be connected to being on the spectrum?
Yeah, I think that when we were going into this study, we thought that we might see a couple of things that were elevated, so that people on the spectrum had higher prevalence of a few conditions that might be particularly high in other populations with developmental disabilities like Down syndrome. We see that things like Alzheimer's disease are much more prevalent. So we thought that we would find a few small things in people on the spectrum. What we didn't expect is that we would see either similar or higher prevalence of almost all things mm-hmm. except for cancer and hypertension and alcohol abuse. So that to us was very, very surprising.
I know you said, Lauren, that the oldest person that has been diagnosed with autism is in his 80s. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure that you're going to need more years of research and data to know this, but can you
make some assumptions about life expectancy for people on the spectrum based on those correlations that you just talked about.
Yeah. So, you know, I want to preface this by saying that this research is at this point still really in its infancy. So in this study, we did look at life expectancy. There have been a couple of other studies that have looked at life expectancy in people on the autism spectrum, and they found between a, I'd say, 15 and 30 year decrease life expectancy in people on the autism spectrum. There was a recent study conducted by a group in Sweden where they have access to really nice population level data that found a 20 year decrease life expectancy, and we replicated that in this study. There are some limitations to our ability to do this at this point, just because we have this big group of people who were diagnosed with autism in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. So our cohort of people on the autism spectrum hasn't quite gotten to the point where we could give really accurate estimates of life expectancy. Mm-hmm. And we, at this point, think that the current generation of older adults with autism might look a little bit different from the current generation of young mm-hmm. adults with autism. They, because diagnostic practices have changed, the current generation of older adults may have more instances of intellectual disability or other developmental disabilities or mental health challenges that the younger generation of people don't have.
We're talking with Lauren Bishop Fitzpatrick. She's an assistant professor of social work at UW-Madison, also a researcher at the UW-Madison Weissman Center. And we're talking about, she's the lead author of a new study. We're talking about that study about the health risks older adults with autism spectrum disorder may be facing. And Lauren, one of the things in preparing for this interview that I was thinking about is, now you have this information that there are these correlations for people living on the spectrum and these certain chronic diseases or conditions. What are the added challenges in treating those people in a way that might be different than people in the general population who are not on the spectrum?
Yeah, I think we do need to do some more work in this area to better understand mechanisms. But something that I commonly hear from people on the spectrum about interfacing with healthcare systems is that, so when you think about people on the spectrum, they, by virtue of their condition, have sensory challenges that make new environments and environments with lots of stimuli, so bright lights, lots of noises, beeping sounds, lots of different things going on in the background, things like that difficult, and then also communicating with people difficult. People on the spectrum may also feel pain differently. So they may, also have differences in the ways that they experience illness or disease. And I think that all of these things really coalesce in a way that could be really disadvantageous to people on the spectrum in healthcare settings, because they're in a new environment. They're in an environment with bright lights. They're in an environment with lots of noise. They're having to communicate with their doctors in a really, really quick interaction that doesn't leave a lot of room for parsing through some of the communication challenges that they might experience.
And I would think, too, the spectrum is very broad, but depending on where someone might be on the spectrum, it might also involve a parent or
yes.
a caregiver or something. And so that could add a whole other dimension
yes.
that there's almost an intermediary that has to also be accommodated.
Right. So, and the intermediary has to also know about the health problems that they may be experiencing or the ways that their body has changed. And I think that another really complicated thing about this is that by the time that people on the spectrum reach middle age, their parents are likely in old age. So when we start to see health problems emerge in the general population in middle age, we would think that people on the spectrum might need more support at doctor's offices, but parents may be unable to provide the same level of support that they were at earlier phases.
And they might be dealing with their own very serious health
yes.
issues as well. You collected data for this research using something called machine learning. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so we didn't collect data for this research. We used data from the electronic health records of people on the spectrum who had received care at the Marshfield Clinic. So what we did with this is that we used, and the Marshfield Clinic, I want to say, has a really wonderful and unique data resource to do this kind of population level research. They've had electronic health records for a very long time, and they're they make them accessible to researchers who have strong partnerships, like we do at the Wasteman Center. And so what we did with this is we used essentially an algorithm to be able to discover new information about the types of health problems that might distinguish people on the spectrum from people in the general population. And what this algorithm does is it combines data in a way that can identify patterns that might distinguish these groups that you wouldn't be able to find if you were to just guess at what things might be different. Mm-hmm. So it's a data-driven approach to look at new research questions.
And I thought it was really interesting because not only were you able to pull out people who had these particular conditions, you were actually able to turn it around and say, oh, this person, mm-hmm. This data point has this combination. They are likely on the spectrum. Mm-hmm. So is there a way that you can use that information in a different way to support mm-hmm. people who are living on the spectrum?
Yeah, well, and I think that one of the things that's interesting about this is that we did this just based on their health problems, not on their developmental history, not on their autism diagnosis, not on mental health problems. This was just based on the health problems they'd had. I think that it would require more testing, but in theory, we might be able to use something similar to this to be able to screen for autism, especially in adults where we know that diagnosis is really hard to come by and really difficult to get somebody who can do the diagnosis. Mm-hmm. So I think it does have potential in the future, but this at this point, I think, is a pilot kind of thing where we need to do a little bit more work.
Sure. And Lauren, as we start to wrap up, what's your hope for how this research, this data, as you get more data on people who are living longer on the spectrum mm-hmm. and you have that information. What's your hope for what this can mean for healthcare provision for people mm-hmm. living with autism spectrum disorder?
Yeah, so, I think that really the goal of this research and the goal of all research that focuses on health and aging and people on the autism spectrum should be to help people on the spectrum live long, healthy, and self-determined lives in their communities, and to help them get the best access to care available and the most tailored health care available to them. So my hope is that we can do more to figure out mechanisms that can help us reach solutions to change the system to help people on the spectrum live better lives for longer.
Well, Lauren, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Lauren Bishop Fitzpatrick is an assistant professor of social work at UW-Madison and a researcher at UW-Madison's Weissman Center. She joined us to talk about new research that finds that older adults with autism spectrum disorder may be at greater risk for developing several health problems, including cardiovascular and respiratory issues. First, there are many ways that we try to live a more eco-friendly life. A lot of us bring canvas bags to the grocery store to avoid all those plastic bags. Most municipalities have a range of recycling services, even for items like electronics. We might buy a car that gets better gas mileage or is even a hybrid vehicle, or maybe we even try to take a bike or walk more to avoid the car altogether. There are a lot of options for green living, but what about how we die? Elizabeth Fournier is a seventh-generation mortician, and she's committed to helping people plan environmentally friendly burials that are also much less expensive for their loved ones. Her new book is The Green Burial Guidebook. Elizabeth, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so very much. I'm thrilled to be here. And do you know my seventh-generation mortician gig actually ties into the state of Wisconsin?
How?
Well, Pisarsky's Funeral Home in Plover and Stevens Point, those are my kinfolk. Turns out they were back in Chicago, now they're here, and the man who started that, Frank, was my father's cousin.
Oh, wow.
So that's where my generations go back. My parents wasn't their thing, but generations back from the other side of the family. So there goes to my Polish family there in Stevens Point.
Wow. Well, we're so glad to have you on, and it's a really interesting topic. And I guess I'd like to start first with how you define and would describe a green burial.
A green burial is things that we're not doing, such as we're not going to have a body who has been embalmed or has any of those chemicals to preserve it. We're going to take that natural body and not put it into a metal casket or a highly shellacked wood casket, and then we're not going to take that burial container and put that into a cemetery grave, which is lined with a concrete or a steel grave liner. So that's three generations of things that we're not doing just to keep it natural.
So there's a pretty big contrast, it sounds like, to the current common burial practices in the U.S. And as opposed to green burial. Your description of green burial strikes me as being how people cared for and buried their dead for centuries or even millennia. How did we get so far removed from death today?
Your insight, Judith, is fantastic. Yes, 150 years ago, this is what we were doing. What had happened was the Civil War came about, and with that, we needed to get our boys back to their towns to have their loved ones be able to have their services for them. So embalming was created. With embalming, we decided to have schooling. Boys went to school. They became the morticians. We had funeral homes. Then there was a funeral business and a cemetery business, and we had goods and services. And basically everything progressed. We're taking care of the nature and doing things simple sort of regressed. So here we are now doing things in what we call more of not a traditional burial way, but more of a modern burial way, which is taking care of goods, services, and finding ways we can do this that isn't exactly old school like we used to.
What do you think we've lost as a result of becoming more distant from the immediacy of death?
I think we've lost a lot of the hands-on, and women used to be the layers of the dead. They were the people who would take care of their loved one when they passed away. They'd bathe them and sing to them and dress them, and they'd have them in the front funeral parlor. And the funeral parlor was the front room in the house. So rather than have them there, then the door would open and we could take them out to our churchyard or our backyard. Actual funeral parlors began springing up in towns where when someone passed away, they'd say, well, give a call to the local funeral parlor. The mortician will come out. They'll put the crape on the door to say this family is in mourning. Leave them alone. This isn't a time to bother them. And we'll just take care of that deceased person. We'll make them look lifelike and beautiful. We'll put them on display, and then we can go ahead and go to a burial park. So we'll take this trouble away from you. So what we lost with that is that sense of people doing it for themselves, people having that moment of reverency to say, wait a minute, this is my loved one. We're going to keep them at home. We're going to do the things we need to do to be part of the family and allow our loved ones to come in and feed them and really honor our person maybe as best as possible or maybe just as natural as they live their life.
Is there a difference, Elizabeth, in how different religions approach burial and, you know, this more immediate family-oriented type of treatment of the dead?
Yeah, you know, that's a really interesting thing to think about because there are some cultures, like the Muslim culture, the Jewish culture, they have been taking care of natural burial for years. That's just what they've done. The idea of wrapping a body in a shroud and getting it to touch the earth within 24 hours is really what they've been doing. Now that Pope Francis has arrived for the Catholic Church, that man is phenomenal in spreading his message of being economical and being environmental. So I'm finding this wonderful brethren of Catholics that are saying, okay, that sounds pretty good. So a lot of Catholic cemeteries across the United States and Canada are opening up one section, their St. Francis section or their St. Gabriel garden, and they're allowing natural burials to happen there where we still can take the body into Mass. We still can have a priest say the prayers. We can consecrate a grave, no issue whatsoever. We're just not having the person embalmed. And we're not paying all the money for an expensive casket, and we're just putting them lightly back into the gentle embrace of the earth.
Speaking of the Catholic Church, a relatively recent development was that the Catholic Church decided that cremation was acceptable. For a long time, it was not. How does cremation fit kind of on that spectrum of very eco-friendly versus the current preferred model that is quite not green in its aspects?
Well, baby boomers decided a while back that they were not going to buy that 32-square-foot piece of land, and they weren't going to go to a cemetery and waste all that space. They were going to get cremated. What we're finding out now with some more education and some more eco-statistics that are growing here from science writers is that one cremation produces so much waste with fossil fuel. We're realizing that the mercury from the fillings is going up into the air and coming back down and feeding chickens and fishes, and we're eating that again. Also, we're finding out that just starting the afterburner or the crematory up to get to the high temperature of the 1,800 degrees to cremate a body, all of that can go to the moon and back so many times, and there's just there's all the stuff that's happening, and this carbon footprint is pretty high. What has come new is the concepts of eco-cremation or aqua-cremation, bio-cremation. There's no set name for this. This is something that was started by the Mayo Clinic, and they were using this in the hospitals, and then after a while it's being used for the animals. But there are 10 states within the union that say, yes, this is a method of disposition. This is something we can do. We can go ahead and use the high pressure of water and think of a nice water bath of your loved one, and not chemicals, but more of a potassium chloride. And after a couple hours, we're going to have the tissue break down, and you're going to end up with the end product as you do with a cremation. You're just going to have the ashes and cremated human remains to give back to somebody. So that's yet another way we're finding out we can have a green disposition. It's not necessarily a burial unless you're burying those cremains, but isn't that fantastic? We're really broadening our parameters here of what we can do to keep it eco-friendly. Mm.
Elizabeth Fournier is a seventh-generation mortician committed to helping people plan environmentally friendly burials. Her new book is The Green Burial Guidebook. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. When the time comes, would you like to have a green burial? What does or doesn't appeal to you about the practice? Have you ever been involved in a green burial of a loved one? What was it like? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up this conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're talking about green burial options with Elizabeth Fournier. She's a seventh-generation mortician, and she works to help people plan environmentally friendly burials. Her new book is The Green Burial Guidebook. If you try to live your life in an environmentally friendly way, have you considered some type of green burial? What would you like to know so you can decide if it's the right choice for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Elizabeth, let's talk about some of the concrete aspects, no pun intended, of green burial. If someone's interested in exploring the options, what are some of the questions they should maybe first ask themselves?
I think the first question would be, where am I going to be buried? And lucky for all of the wonderful Wisconsin's people who are listening to this, there's plenty of spaces and cemeteries in your state that does this. You know, there's two in the Milwaukee area, which is really amazing, mm-hmm. right there within the city limits. And if you head east on I-94, you get to the town of Waukesha. Am I pronouncing that correct?
Actually, Waukesha.
Waukesha. Oh, that's even better. Waukesha. Sounds cool. So there's one there, and if you're going to go, keep on going due east of there, past Madison, Highway 18, you get to Verona, and then continue on, and Barneveld has another one. So there's a lot of choices there that allow people just to go ahead and have a natural cemetery. And also, did you know in your state you can bury people on their own private land?
Wow. And what constitutes private land? Are we talking a minimum of several acres, or are we talking an urban backyard?
Well, how it works with Wisconsin, and it's important to know that most states have specific rules how this works. There's really nothing at the state level which regulates the burial on the private land. So what needs to happen is everything is a local ordinance, meaning if you're going to think even about having a grave dug, you'll need to check with your town or your county clerk or even the local health department and ask for any rules. And what you're really going to do is run your address past them. They probably want to make sure you have at least an acre, you're in a rural area, and then there'll be setbacks as far as are you away from a watershed, are you away from a neighbor's property, and there's all the steps like that. So it is legal. Of course, you have to file this with the property deed because we want to make sure that if you are going to be selling the property down the road, we let this be known. But Wisconsin is one of those fantastic states that is really open to traditional burial and modern burial and just making people have as many choices as possible.
Let's go to the phones, and Tim in Eau Claire is up first. Hi, Tim.
Hi. So I'm in my 30s, and I've, since I was a little kid, always had a connection, very strong connection with a specific cemetery. It's always been my quiet place. Hmm. I want to build my own coffin. That's where I want to be buried. The only issue is the rules there don't allow anybody to be buried without a cement box around them, which is kind of counter to what I, you know, really want. Hmm. And I'm hoping that you might be able to point me in some direction, or maybe, you know, give me some keywords that I might be able to, some buzzwords I might be able to use with them to convince them to allow me to do it.
So, Tim, if I'm understanding the situation, you feel very connected to this particular cemetery, but that cemetery, at least currently, does not allow the type of burial that you also feel very connected with. So you're kind of have a conflict between the two.
Exactly. I'm kind of between a concrete box and a hard place.
thanks for that, well, Tim. Elizabeth, what would you recommend?
You. I would suggest him keep being himself, for one thing. He sounds like a phenomenal human. I also think that there's two things we can do. One is, if you ask, you shall receive. And if you keep asking the cemetery, well, why can't we have a concrete liner not be part of my burial? After a while, they might say, well, it's just the rules. And then maybe they'll look at reevaluating their rules. That's how any pioneer, historic, small cemetery has decided, oh, okay, this is what we'll do. If they really don't want to budge their rules and your time is coming to pass, then what they probably can do, and you might want to check this prior, is they can take that concrete liner and, rather than have it in the ground, have your beautiful homemade casket put inside and have that concrete lid on top. They merely can have you in the ground first and then put that concrete liner on upside down. So you're following me? That way you're touching the earth. Concrete is around you, so it satisfies keeping the soil and the earth where they want it to be, so they have the sparkly, beautiful memorial ground, but then you're still touching the earth. Yes, you still will be lined by concrete, but boy, oh boy, you got to be one with nature quicker than you thought.
So you're saying that instead of it being open on the top and the body being placed inside that, Elizabeth, the body is placed in and it's put as kind of, this is a horrible analogy, but like the cover on a butter plate.
That's perfect, Judith. It makes a visual. That's what we need in radio. That makes perfect sense. And I'm finding that's what a lot of Jewish cemeteries do, because they don't want that wavy, gravy look. They want it really green and nice, but they do that where the loved one does touch the earth, but the cemetery soil doesn't look like anything happened.
Well, I hope that helps, Tim. Definitely let us know if you have any success with that, convincing that cemetery. Let's go now to Louise in Shatek. Hi, Louise.
Hi. I am a home funeral guide and have been for 6 years in our area, and I help families when they call after the medical examiner has done their thing. I help them prepare the body and keep it for up to 2 to 3 days, depending on what they want to do. And I began to work with the local cemeteries to see if we can't get a couple spots for green burial. I agree with the lady talking that a lot of people, I think, cremate because they can't afford the burial. And if we could have green burial, I think more people would use that. And I find the home funerals, if you've never been involved, they are the most peaceful thing. Because people can take their time to say goodbye. They don't have someone looking at you to make sure you're crying enough or not crying enough or all that kind of stuff. So,
thank you for that, Louise. And actually, Elizabeth, that brings up an issue that I wanted to talk with you about. Louise said that she helps people and really accompanies them through the process of having a home burial. One of the questions, it seems to me, that someone interested in green burial really needs to reflect on is this something that my family, my loved ones, are going to be comfortable with? Because it really is a much more immediate experience of death of someone very close to you.
Yes, and thank you, Louise, for your call. Thank you for the work you do. What she said is very reflective of natural burial, in the sense if you do keep your loved one at home, for instance, you don't have that 1 hour visitation slot at the funeral parlor, you can spend your time, you can say goodbye. Fortunately, again, Wisconsin, one of these wonderful states that restores families' rights, in the sense where you can act as your own funeral home, your own funeral director, you can be involved with whatever you need as far as transportation and these things. So also hiring home funeral guides to help. That's probably something that people should Google and take a look at. I don't think we have too much time to go too much deep into that. But it is important, like you mentioned, Judith, that you discuss with your family what you want when you pass. And if you do want a green burial, is everybody on board? Do they have questions? Does it sound just crazy, or does it sound like something they'd be comfortable with? There are so many videos. There's so much information. If no one has heard of it before and they think you're off your rocker, you can lead them to just wonderful videos on YouTube that show a peaceful family spending time together. And it's important, too, if you're going to take care of this for yourself or somebody else, you have a team. If you're going to drive a vehicle, who has that vehicle? Are they up to doing this? If you're going to make a shroud or a casket, can somebody do this? Do they know what they're doing? What if the burial and the death happen much quicker than you thought? What if it's freezing cold tundra out there because you're in the middle of winter? Things sometimes happen. So I think the best laid plans are beautiful and be easy on yourself, because sometimes your family or whomever just can't make it happen, and that's just okay.
Let's go next to Janet, who's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Janet.
Hi. I just wanted to say that the first time I saw a green burial was in the HBO series 6 Feet Under. As soon as I saw it, that last one, I went to the historic Forest Home Cemetery in Milwaukee. They already had one prepared. It's at the back end of the cemetery, and it's all native Wisconsin flowers, prairie grasses, trees, and, you know, they show you, you know, well, where do you want yours? And I bought it the same day. It included the unearthing, you know, the somebody has to dig up the earth. Excuse me. The only thing is, nothing metal, because you must be biodegradable, and so must your shroud, or, you know, no nails in a pine box. It has to be pegged. Or you can just go in a shroud. My mother gave me her best nightgown. I took the buttons off. I have everything written out. It's all ready to go. And my family is deceased or moved away. So it's, to me, it's like, yeah, I want to go back to where I came from. So, and it was very, very affordable, less than $1,000. And I'm locked in. They do have a granite rock for when you do experience your date of death, and then they put your date of death on there. And there's a little swing, and, you know, it's charming.
Thank you so much for that, Janet. And Elizabeth, it does seem like there are more and more options. As you said, it's not an either or. There are these cemeteries that, do traditional, well, that do modern burials, and others that do green. It seems like there are some that do both.
There are. And what Janet's talking about is the Forest Home Cemetery, and that's foresthomecemetery.com. And they're in Milwaukee proper. And the beautiful thing is they're called a hybrid cemetery, which means they already were taking care of burials the way that most of us think of a burial, with a headstone and just your traditional-looking casket. But what they decided was they were going to open up their park and allow natural burials to come. So they do have that example in the back of the park that says this is what this looks like, rather than the green grass that we're going to put the chemicals on and that we're going to make sure is mowed. We're going to have just whatever natural foliage comes up, and the vines and the beautiful wildflowers, and this will be your resting place and probably a boulder for a headstone. When she talks about the idea of a shroud, I don't know if people realize this, but a shroud could be the beautiful cotton sheet off your bed. Just something to wrap your body with, something that allows you to move. You probably will need some sort of straps to physically move you to where you need to go. But nonetheless, a shroud doesn't have to be something that somebody hand-sewed or you bought off the Internet. This can be a piece of material from the fabric store. Of course, something that's non-bleached, organic cotton is good, wool, silk, muslin, linen, there's all these materials that you can use, but boy, that's a really inexpensive burial container.
We're running short on time, but I want to make sure we had a couple callers call to say that there's also the Farley Center for Peace, Justice, and Sustainability. It's about 20 miles outside of Madison. It's in Verona, and they have the Natural Path Sanctuary, which is also a green burial area.
Right, yes, Verona, and don't forget the Barneveld, am I saying that correctly?
Yes.
Okay, right, and then that really fun name that you told me has the Prairie Home Cemetery there.
That's
so.
Waukesha. We'll have to leave it there, Elizabeth. Thank you so much for joining us today. Elizabeth Fournier joined us to talk about green burials. Her new book is The Green Burial Guidebook. Our wonderful state turns 170 years old today. Wisconsin was founded on May 29, 1848, and became the 30th state in the Union. WisTravel.com provided some fun Wisconsin facts for the day. Feel free to quiz yourself. I'll try not to blurt out the answer too quickly. Wisconsin has a state bird. I have seen suggestions that it's actually the mosquito, but the official state bird is the American robin. There is a Wisconsin state dog that I didn't realize. It is the American Water Spaniel. I'm guessing that's because of our maritime history. Wisconsin state fish. Think of the biggest, most prehistoric looking one you can think of. That's a muskie. That's been the state fish for over 60 years. Wisconsin state flower. It's a fairly diminutive one. We have the wood violet as our state flower. One of the most recent official Wisconsin state items as of 1989 is the state grain. That is corn. Wisconsin state insect, again, could have been the mosquito, I think, but it is the honeybee, which I like. There is a Wisconsin state mineral. I'm not sure that every state has one of those. It is galena or lead, and that is also where we got the nickname badgers, since the lead miners would sleep in burrows in the hillside where they were mining. And finally, here's a taste of the Wisconsin state dance. Yes, it is the polka. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.